You're listening to Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. This episode, getting the band back together with guest Kristen Martin. Well, if you're just joining us, we have tonight a wonderful guest, Kristen Martin, Destroyer of Worlds! How are you doing, Kristen?
No pressure. Oh. Yeah.
You and Galactus.
I don't know if I can live up to that. Hopefully I can.
I don't know. I think you've done a whole bunch, so why not, you know? I say work it.
Now, is it true, I've heard tell, that am I really the first guest of the female persuasion that you've had on your show? Is that true?
Indeed. Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun. You know, aside from, you know, Maggie, but she's a host.
No, she's so. A host, though. Yeah. Yeah.
And depending on the day, really, me.
When you're dusting the plants and cleaning the drapes, yes.
Right, precisely. No, I've got minions for that, thank the gods.
I think I also have the same distinction on the VFX show and perhaps No Tech.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You're the only one. You're the unicorn.
Not the only one, but the first one.
But the first one. There we go. Well, yes. I kind of wondered about that because it seems that women in the field are kind of rare.
Yes, I would say so.
And I guess it depends on which field you're talking about, too. In the technical side, then, yeah. The podcasting side, not so much.
Because there are a lot of female podcasters out there, but as far as the engineering side, it seems to be, well, a lot of them do everything themselves. If they've got a dedicated engineer, yeah, I guess their females are few and far between.
Yeah, so I found, and it's been the case for pretty much my entire adult life that whatever I've been doing, I've been one of the only females involved, so.
Gasp, say you know, whether it's true.
I've never had a problem with it since, you know, the time I was a kid. All my best friends were guys, so I never have really experienced, like, a lot of the horror stories you hear about from other women in tech that I've been reading about lately. I guess I've been fortunate in that regard.
I'm primarily in application development and such, and yeah, females are the elusive winged unicorn. They're not even just unicorns. They're winged unicorns. And I don't know what it is, but... And maybe it's just because, you know, and this is going to be raging stereotypes on all sides here, but, you know, a lot of engineers, not so much with the being around females and therefore not quite understanding what's appropriate and what's not for general public company versus your frat house.
Yeah, just no social skills, basically.
Right. And also, engineers tend to be a little bit Asperger-y, potentially, and just the general awkwardness is amplified. I mean, I've certainly noticed that. Various chat rooms and such can get a little bit heady, shall we say.
Yeah, that tends to keep women from, you know, participating, but not from, you know, wanting to do the thing in the first place. So,
which is also the other thing where it wasn't that long ago where there simply weren't a lot of women in computer science, for example, or engineering. There were always a small handful. Certainly throughout history, we know some fairly famous ones, but they still seem to be a bit of an anomaly and a curiosity rather than a real force. And now, all that's changed.
Yeah. I mean, because, you know, for a long time we were writing the tale of the period where women were actively discouraged from working in, you know, fields like that, both culturally and by people in the fields themselves. So, you know, I work in a building that did not have any women's restrooms until the 80s.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Maybe, maybe 70s. They had to go to another building. The secretaries had to go to another building.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of doors where the sign is, like, screwed on because it's covering up the one that says men's restroom, you know.
Wow. Yeah, it still has urinals.
Oh, no. They did. Yeah, they just left that in there.
That would have been brilliant.
And until we had, the first female director of our lab, I mean, the faculty room was men only.
Wow, that whole idea astonishes me.
Right. But it's like, not it's that long so ago, but to you right. and I, it's totally foreign. But there's a tale of that we've just come out of, which I think is allowing women to make the moves into things that they want to do or that they've been actively discouraged from before.
It also seems that now the enrollment in most universities is primarily female these days as well. So the entire tide is changing.
Oh, yeah, that's amazing.
Which is, A, pretty cool, because, again, the more people who are educated, the better. And in a lot of emerging countries, for example, the emphasis is on educating the women, because the women are also still on top of everything else. They're also usually the caregivers for, you know, their children and the family in general. So having them be educated usually winds up creating a better atmosphere for their children. They often have less children, so it's less of a burden potentially on, you know, a potential burden on not only the family, but society as a whole. And so this is a really exciting time.
Yeah, it's interesting where in the department that I just joined at the office, it's all women. So in the video and media department. So
really?
At other locations, there's men, certainly. But at the San Francisco one, it's all women.
Wow.
That's amazing.
So recently, yeah, I moved over from quite a long stint in web development, and now I've moved over to doing exclusively video. Senior tech producer will be my new title.
Neat. So what exactly is a technical producer versus a producer?
Basically, we have like a regular producer would be someone who goes out in the field and puts together crews and, you know, organizes things on location, whereas I deal more with the production side, the post-production side, and also as a kind of a liaison for all our tech vendors. So basically figuring out best practices for video on the web and solutions for digital asset management and that sort of thing.
Wild. You know, knowing and understanding a bit of the production that goes along with creating something of that, you know, magnitude, you know, it's a lot of people and it's a lot of stuff and it's a lot of assets, and everything has to come together smoothly. I mean, we've got a tiny little podcast and it's the two of us, and it's, you know, we struggle getting that done in a reasonable time frame. So I can't imagine what it's like to deal with something that's a little bit more full production and dealing with all those disparate activities, tasks and all that.
Oddly enough, I'd say that compared to my experience, say, with PixelCorp, mm-hmm. this is like a walk in the park, because that was really...
Well, you
that
mentioned...
That was extreme cat herding.
Well, that's where I first encountered your work, actually, with the Pixel Core and doing the VFX show and working with Alex and Kanan and all those old school folk.
And the rest.
Well, yeah, it's a bit like...
Marianne.
but it's interesting. Yeah, I went from like sort of... I ramped up really quick with Pixel Core. I joined like in, I guess, early 2000, about mm-hmm. the time that I started really heavily doing a lot of video editing. And I went from sort of being just a general member to like being director of the podcast production group in, you know, a very short amount of time. Everything was really ramping up when all the shows were getting underway. And when we first started the podcast production group, I was overseeing like 65, 70 volunteers. And unfortunately, because of maybe the way things were handled, that dwindled down to just a core group. But I think that really happens a lot when you have a volunteer situation. You always whittle it down to people who are really committed.
Right. Because you get a lot of people who are excited. I want to do that.
Both metaphorically and literally. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Well, those excited people, you know, the real world kicks in for a lot of them, so...
Well, right. I mean, it's also volunteer, right? When you have a real job, that usually takes precedence, and you know, it just becomes difficult to sustain, you know, a large body, especially when you guys are producing so much real stuff.
Yeah, it was really hard too, because you have some people that come into a situation like that, and I'm sure this is true for something like the visual effects industry, where people have certain stars in their eyes and they think that, you know, it's going to be all beer and Skittles or whatever, and then they find out that, you know, the harsh reality of that you have to put in a lot of time, and either as a very low pay or as a volunteer to get ahead, and people get disillusioned. And
well, this is very early too in the nascent podcast industry, I guess you'd say, where it was really growing up outside of what was established. How many shows were you guys doing?
Trying to think, but it was somewhere. They had some that took off better than others, and some that ended up taking off after I left the scene. But I think it was probably in the neighborhood of 10 to 15. Yeah.
That's fairly significant.
Yeah. And the one that I really gravitated towards, well, the two were, well, Gear Media Tech. I co-produced and edited and did product reviews for the first 18 episodes of that, co-produced with John Foster. The other one that I really gravitated towards was, of course, the VFX show, which I kept doing kept producing for 2 years, and I was a guest on that too. I think I was on 5 shows.
I remember all those shows when they were rolling. It seemed that there was a new show or a new type of show coming out every week from the beginning at that point. So you'd wind up experimenting and listening and saying, like, you know, this is purely from a listener's perspective, because I was really digging what you guys were doing. It seemed that this was all very nascent and people were still trying to get their sea legs and trying to figure out what it's all about. You guys and a few others, they started kind of figuring out a formula that sort of worked, which is nice, you know, figuring out, oh, okay, well, podcast should be about this long. You'd have a lot of stuff that was timely as well. And it seems to me that you could almost divide the different shows into two basic categories. You'd have like the news panel shows where everything was timely, and there was, it seemed to me, very little editing was done. I'm sure there was a lot of editing.
It was a quick turnaround on those, and then you have the stuff that was more evergreen. I mean, the VFX show was totally evergreen. I mean, we'd have people downloading the first episodes because they wanted to go back, and I mean, the movies are not going anywhere. So,
right.
But you know, something like This Week in Media or something, I mean, that had a pretty limited shelf life. People would just download it that week, and then the next one would be out. So, and the turnarounds on those were insane. So.
Yeah, I was going to say, did you, with all those shows in the pipeline at once, did you ever sleep?
Well, the good thing at that point, I was a freelancer, so I could pretty much afford to, or I guess maybe not.
Oh, dear.
I was working, you know, I was working from home as a freelancer, so I had the luxury, I guess, to be able to devote a lot of time to it. Not everyone had that luxury. A lot of people who volunteered, they, okay, I can put in whatever, 10 hours a week, 5 hours a week, but I have a real job, so a day job. So that did get in the way. And that's something that comes into play a lot, I think, if you're in a situation that's a volunteer run.
Yeah, actually, right. I played Ben Durbin on the island for a short period when he left to fill in. And that was kind of the thing too. It's like, I have some time, not a lot of time. But sounds like though on the island, you were definitely the professor building stuff out of coconuts.
Oh, totally.
Yes. I'm glad you said it.
There was so much going on at once, and even the gear was changing because the budgets were nil ostensibly, and again, it's a volunteer organization, just scrounging for gear and trying to get it all straightened out. The technology was also ramping up so rapidly. I imagine that, at least it seemed to me, that the quality level, the audio quality level of the podcasts would change fairly dramatically week to week. And I thought that was also really interesting that you guys weren't really resting on your laurels. You were actively trying to make everything better.
Well, I think there was the bar was set pretty high as far as what we aspired to for, you know, audio quality and video quality for the video podcasts. We didn't always reach that. I think a lot of the panel shows where people were recording stuff over Skype, I had like an ongoing issue with having to do a lot of post on the VFX show because we had a different panel of guests each week and some people had a better setup than others. So Isotope RX, my best friend, you know, noise reduction.
Good to know. Well, that was, and that's the other thing too. It's like, well, especially nowadays, you know, that was back then when technology was emergent and it was still kind of expensive. So getting new gear was kind of difficult. Now the gear is so cheap that the barrier of entry is so low, which is fantastic because that allows people who were never able to do something have a pretty close to broadcast quality sound to their show, which is great. Our setup is very simple. I think it was all said and done. I spent a little bit more money than I probably should have. For less than $1,000, I've got a really, really good setup for what I do. If I did it over again, I could probably do it for $400 or less. That's pretty amazing.
It is. And even thinking about, you know, my time working in a post-production audio facility, I mean, just the fact that that you can do this outside of that. It's just still amazing to me. And the price of things comes down. I mean, things like condenser microphones, I mean, used to be so out of reach for anyone. And now it's like, you know, there's so many knockoffs. You could get something for, you know, well under $100. Everything from the software even has changed so much and has become so affordable. You know, it's just the barrier, like you say, the barrier to entry. It's just, you can't, yeah, anyone can do it, basically.
Yeah, which is great. And it used to be even the software, while it became affordable, you know, you'd have GarageBand or what have you, which was basically free with every Mac, you know, every iMac, every Mac Pro, they all came with it. The downside, though, is that for a very long time, especially with GarageBand and even Logic Pro, I think had the same problem. You would record, and if it was roughly over an hour, I remember it being like, if you recorded roughly over an hour, very bad things started to happen.
There were certain things like a 2 gig file limit or something like that. And then I know GarageBand had an even lower limit with some of the earlier versions, where I think if you went past like 30 minutes or something,
What song is more than 30 minutes, right?
Well, right, exactly. The engine, and that's why I think Logic Pro had the same problem, because it basically used the same audio engine, and it was made for short sampling, looping type of stuff. It wasn't meant for this long form recording, whereas Soundtrack Pro, that's what I used to record on, in the beginning, because it didn't have that problem. As a matter of fact, it was the only thing I could find that didn't cost like $1 jillion. Like, I wasn't going to shell out for Pro Tools for something I wasn't going to get paid for. And I happened to have Final Cut Studio, so bam, here it was for free. And I used that. And it happened to have some pretty good plugins and little helpers there, that all the anti-click and pop and all that.
Soundtrack Pro, I know that a few of my colleagues, like, for example, John Foster, hate it, but it's underrated. I've done some great things with it. I did all the classes that I did for FX PhD that I recorded with that, and all the VFX show post-production I did in that. And I just thought it was a great tool. I love Pro Tools. Don't get me wrong. I've been a dyed-in-the-wool Pro Tools user since before the dawn of time. The problem with Pro Tools is the real-time bounce.
Oh, yeah.
Ouch. And if you're doing a long-form show, I mean, do you really want to wait that long to output your show? No.
Yeah, that's totally ridiculous. And I still don't understand why. I mean, you would figure that the bounce would happen as fast as the CPU could possibly do it. It's almost as if they're artificially limiting it.
I feel that way with a lot of the stuff Avid does with, I don't know much about their video side, but just with, everything they've done sort of with the, you know, development of Pro Tools, it's like, oh, we're the only game in town. Screw you, basically.
We can do what
we want. We're just not going to bother certifying things for new OSs or bringing our tool up to date with, you know, the current century.
There used to be two operating systems behind.
Oh, yes. It's like, oh, we're not going to certify things, you know, for any new CPUs or new OSs. It's like, we're the only game in town. Just keep your old hardware and your...
Right. And their forums would be full of their cheerleaders going, well, the tech team is furiously working on this, you know, and it's like, shut up.
You are not.
Prove it.
Yeah, exactly. You're just
pictures,
you know,
or it didn't happen.
Yeah, but you know, I love Pro Tools. I mean, there's definitely great things about it, but it's just that particular real-time bounce thing, especially if you're working in podcasting and you're doing shows that are long form. I mean, that's just going to basically be a deal breaker and force you to use some other tool.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, the old Avid turnkey systems, you know, you wouldn't buy just the software, you had to buy the hardware, the whole thing.
Their drives, Avid.
And, you know, they were based on Quadra 950s, you know, because they had the 6 NUBUS cards.
Under 950s.
NUBUS slots. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, it wouldn't work otherwise.
Well, right.
But I mean, not just because of the requirements. I mean, just because, the rest of the hardware wasn't up to snuff.
Well, and it used, if I recall correctly, it used all 6 slots as well. which was just total madness. You know, they
there will not be room for anything else.
No.
Sorry. You know, do not play nice with anything else.
Yeah, they had their own SCSI cards, they had their own video accelerator cards, they had, you know, and they just stacked. And that's what you got. Ostensibly, like, you know, the old Quantel paint box turnkey systems, you know, you basically bought your box from Quantel,
right,
and it had the software on it, and that's all it did.
And that's why people started calling it an Avid, even if it was not, you know, it's not a computer built by Avid, but it's a computer so full of Avid that that's all that you expect to do with it.
And you still hear that.
Yeah. Yeah.
People,
maybe we did,
you know,
on
that
the Avid.
Did you right. get an Avid?
Yeah. Now, I think there's a salve for that now, or at least a poultice or something.
There's an incantation or something.
There we go.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, command option RP something. I don't know.
Right. Oh, dear.
You mentioned FX PhD. You also worked there as well, did you not?
I did a course for them. FX PhD. Basically visual effects training, but they've done a few, I guess, sort of as a test balloon, they've done a few audio courses and also, I think, things like photography and Photoshop. So it's not exclusively visual effects applications and training. So I did, because I was involved with the VFX show, I was, of course, friends with Mike Seymour from FX PhD, and they mentioned they wanted to do a an intro to digital audio course. And my friend and I, we basically said, okay, we'd be interested in putting that together. And we did a course for them, and it ran for 3 terms. And then I think they also put it in their vault, which is just old courses where there's no instructor like helping you along. It's just you can purchase the whole thing and watch it as on demand, basically. So, but yeah, that was a lot of fun. It was a very interesting experience. And, you know, the screen recording tools at that time that we had at our disposal aren't, you know, up to today's standards. We didn't have ScreenFlow or anything like that. So it was all...
The quality level of the FX PhD stuff has always been really top notch. I mean, you hear other people talking about it all the time, and the ones that I've seen, which is admittedly very limited, I always learned a huge amount from their courses, much more so than a lot of the other online courses that are available.
It's head and shoulders and above something like lynda.com. They had problems, like stumbles in the beginning with things like audio quality, but they really set their standards high, like early on. And the content is great. It's fabulous. I mean, before I was an instructor, I was, you know, a customer. So I relearned After Effects, you know, based on their material and Cinema 4D and things I use every day at work. So it's great material.
Well, they used the faculty model, you know, where there was always when by faculty, I mean, like, you know, you were getting content from professionals, and it was, you know, oftentimes a brain dump of a particular professional. Like your course basically is, here's a professional telling you how stuff happens in the real world. So you know, a lot of people that I know that watched it, that's what they appreciated was, it was a breadth of knowledge that came from somewhat authority.
You know, subject matter experts is people that work in the field, and it's definitely practical knowledge. And the other really great thing that I found with their courses is the footage and the source material they would give you when you signed up. So you would get stuff use on your reel. They had no restrictions of, you basically got a lot of source material. Like for the course I did, we provided tons and tons of stuff for people to use. And it was the same for like the After Effects courses and Cinema 4D and everything like that, where you would get, you know, real world, you know, HD footage to play with and use on your reel. So I think that's definitely a big draw.
Oh, it's huge. It seems to me that it's very similar to the way the School of Visual Arts works in Manhattan, where you've got these subject matter experts who have real day jobs. You know, they are out in the field working every day. They also happen to teach a class. They tell you exactly what it's like to work in the various applications and the core concepts that you wouldn't necessarily get if you were just going to like a lynda.com or what have you. It's a much better, much more real world learning.
Yeah, you're not just learning the features of the application or the technique. It's actually things you would practically use in a day-to-day production environment. It's a good thing.
Yeah, the FX PhD stuff. Yeah, and again, it's not cheap, But it's definitely worth checking out if you haven't, or if you want to know more about a particular, more about certain techniques. That was pretty much my go-to for really understanding After Effects. And because that, After Effects for me for the longest time was the most opaque application ever. I actually started using it when it was still owned by COSA. And it was a lot simpler then. And then Adobe took it over. And I'm like, I don't know where I am anymore.
It's really funny with the COSA thing. I have quite a history with After Effects. I have two family members who work in visual effects, and they both started out using After Effects when it was owned by COSA. And so, like, I version whatever, the early, very early, like 1.0 type of thing. So it's always funny. Like, they're like, oh, you have it so easy now.
Basically, everything was manually done. There was no, you had your keyframes, but there was no programmatic adjustments that you could do. You couldn't animate.
There wasn't expressions and scripting and stuff like that. Just to go back to my whole web development thing. I mean, I've been using Flash since it was, whatever, Future Splash Animator. Yeah, I was like an original beta tester on that. Yeah, so it was used to be just a timeline animation tool, and then of course the whole sort of ecosystem grew up around it, and ActionScript went through all its various incarnations, and love it or hate it, it was responsible for a lot of very very innovative content.
Especially at the time where nothing else
and
could
do
that.
It's the same with After Effects, where it's like it's so much more than the animation program. I mean, people do such amazing things with it. It's I'm sure the teams for both of those applications never envisioned like the extent to which this stuff would be used.
I know and this is a little bit embarrassing to say, but I've actually produced entire very, very short form videos entirely in After Effects, cut in After Effects, and did all the visual effects and then exported.
Well, it used to be Stu's joke about doing and After Effects, and then telling you don't do that, but you can, and here's how you do it.
I don't suggest doing it, but I'm just saying that
you can try this out.
because it's not the best tool for the job for all of those things.
Stuck on a desert island, I might just have to take After
I would
Effects
definitely take After Effects
thing.
And just speaking of the whole like right tool for the job, I mean, we're kind of in this thing right now where, I mean, is there one right tool for the job? There's so many different applications out there, and all the announcements recently at NAB, where it seems like I don't think anyone working in post-production can say, oh, I definitively, this is a clear winner, this is the only application I'm going to use.
And I don't know anyone that uses, like, I don't know anyone who has that one tool mentality either anymore. There are some people that say, oh, I'm a Flame person, whatever, but everyone ends up using different tools, and then inside those tools they end up out of convenience using them for things that you wouldn't necessarily consider that the right tool for. But I like having that the added benefit. So if you pop over into After Effects to do something that's an After Effects thing, and you go, oh, and while I'm here, I'm going to do this, that's great.
Now that budgets are also so tight and cutters are asked, or anyone actually is asked to do more and more, people are going to naturally move to different tools as they see fit. It used to be when you were doing freelance, you would go into their setup, whoever hired you, you'd go into their setup and use their bay. And if you didn't know how to use Avid, or if you didn't know how to use Final Cut Pro, you didn't get a job.
Now you're just expected to be multi-talented. And I think more and more, even like just a straight up editor is, expected to do motion graphics. They might be expected to do producing and editing. They might have to do some minor visual effects. And it's just, so you just have to use a wide variety of tools. You're going to be hopping in and out of applications all day, basically.
Right. We don't have the handoff anymore where you go into Avid and you edit and then you hand it off to somebody. Where lots of times you're doing a little bit more. We're in the era of the suite, and in particular, the new, another love letter to Adobe, the new Adobe Creative Suites.
Yes. Oh, the cloud arrives in a few days. Actually, by the time this drops,
we'll
the cloud
arrived,
will be here.
We will be in it. And the whole Creative Cloud thing to me is just fascinating. I sat through their whole Creative Cloud launched dog and pony show, and it was, it just seems like it's a winning formula for the package of stuff they're offering and the price.
It's pretty amazing. The whole idea, you know, it may not work for a lot of people, and I have heard some backlash against it. I think the backlash that you're hearing is people not really understanding what it's all about. I think that, A, if you are a long-time Adobe Creative Suite user, the upgrade price for the disk version, I think it pretty much evens out versus the Creative Cloud, assuming that you have the master collection with everything. But if you don't, suddenly for, what was it, 30 bucks a month? 40,
50 well, bucks it was, and it was 50 30 bucks if you already own a Creative Suite 3, right. 4, or 5, or 5.5.
And, I mean, that just becomes, wow, suddenly everything is available to me? That's great. And what if I'm in a production house and we have 5 employees, for sake of argument, and then we get a really big account and it's crunch time. We need to hire some freelancers, but we need to have them in-house for whatever reason. Now I can buy a month or two of 6 additional seats for ostensibly it's free.
That's a very, very hot prospect.
It's basically a no-brainer that for that amazing. Kind of, you know, like small boutique venture that can add the seats as you need them instead of having to invest this in a perpetual license for something where you're not going to have the few months go by and it's like, oh, yeah, well, gee, now we have all these licenses.
Right, when the huge movie's over and you have to go tell the troops, well, now that we've established our VFX house, we're probably going to get steamrolled like the rest. But, hey, we didn't have to pay as much for our tools.
Like, for example, there is that. There was a small, they did production and post-production house called Bravo, of all things, in the building of my former office. They were very small. You know, they didn't have a lot of seats, but occasionally they would come up to us and say, hey, can we borrow some of your machines? And we would do the same thing because we wouldn't, you know, we did web development, right? And so we very rarely had to film things, although when we did, it was always on this ridiculously tight deadline for, we did this thing for HBO. Actually, we did this thing for Game of Thrones. We did the companion guide for Game of Thrones, and we made it all iPad-tastic and all that sort of thing, and we decided to create...
iPad-tastic? Oh, that's definitely... iPad-tastic, that's my word of the day.
There we go. And it was a heck of a lot of fun to make. The team that did it was just... They really knocked it out of the park. It was absolutely beautiful. It behaved well on the iPad. It worked well on a traditional desktop. And then so we decided to make a film, like a small short video of what it was like to use it as a small screen companion while you were watching Game of Thrones. Having a little bit of experience in the whole production aspect, I decided, it's like, well, you know, I've got a 5D Mark II. I can probably get a second camera. And then 2 days later, we had a film, but we had to go through the whole approval process and all that sort of thing. And so we wound up using their facility, and it would have been really great to be able to say, hey, Adobe, beam me down After Effects and Premiere Pro for the month. You know,
because it's definitely, you know, that whole subscription model. I mean, it's used with other things like, you know, plugin suites and, you know, the Sapphire plugins and everything. That's a lot of the, and there's, I think, even in with some of the audio plugins, that's been an option for a long time where you would just license it for the term of project. And then after that, you don't have it anymore. So it's just, I think the way they've packaged this whole Creative Cloud thing, it makes it very compelling with the storage and the extra touch apps and all that, all those add-ons, those value adds. And where before they did have a subscription offering, but I just don't think they were closing the deal as far as, oh, this is what would make you plunk down this kind of cash for it.
Yeah, especially considering, I think a lot of people were also under the impression of, oh, well, if I stop paying, then I no longer have access to it. And while, yes, that's true, it really comes down to, do I pay $2,400 times X number of seats all up front, or do I pay 30 bucks a month times X seats per month? And for a lot of people, it's a hell of a lot easier to just afford that, you know, that cheaper way.
They bill it through, you know, they bill that through.
Yeah, that's a thing.
Oh, right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes it a much easier way to work it out. And also, now that they're going to ramp up to a yearly cycle, because before it was, what, roughly 18 months-ish?
It was 18 months, yeah. Ish. Yeah.
Ish, you know. And the 5.5 thing, it's like, yeah, the big update was Premiere Pro and After Effects, but Illustrator and Photoshop weren't really revved all that much. As a matter of fact, Photoshop in CS5.5 is actually called 5.1.
Yeah, it's like it's barely deserving of a, you know, a dot.
Right.
A dot release.
That's, of course, that's because it got the attention, you know, first. So,
yeah, there we are.
Well, I mean, it got the attention previous, you know, that the other apps did not. Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're going to now launch every year as opposed to every 18 months, it makes so much more sense to not buy it outright as well, because you're just going to wind up wanting to buy it next year, you know.
Right, and I know they've kind of dangled this promise of, like, people who are on the, you know, Creative Cloud plan, you know, will get the upgrades, you know, the incremental upgrades first before the people with perpetual licenses do. And it's I think it's a little interesting to see how to, you know, watch how that'll play out. I know that they've been touting that as a big feature for a while now.
Yeah, I'm also curious if people who are on the Creative Cloud, if they want to convert one seat or n number of seats to the traditional spinning disk version, do they get the upgrade rate, or do they have to sort of start from scratch? How is that going to work as well?
They've been pretty coy about that. It's just like all the events I've gone to, both in person and webinar type things, people have asked questions like that, and they're like, well, you know, we'll refer you to this. We're not commenting on things that aren't products that aren't released yet. And it's like, I'm not sure that they've worked out all the details.
Yeah, if you had a subscription, and even if you paid yearly, because I think that was also the catch as well. It's like, yeah, it's $30, but you've got to pay for a year up front or something like that.
You agree to a year term, but you don't have to pay up front. But you do, if you do cancel within the first 6 months, you pay for the first 6 months. If you cancel within the second 6 months, you pay for that. So it's not like you're paying up. You're still paying $30 a month or $50 a month, whatever your rate is, but you have to agree to the term. It's like less onerous than a cell phone contract, but
Well, that's rather humane, and that's a really good thing, and they should be congratulated on doing something that doesn't totally suck. I don't know, in this day and age where, yeah, you've got everyone, like phone companies and all that, they're trying to screw you in every possible way they can. The cinemas, the on DVD, etc., you know, they're all saying, oh, well, you know, it's a license for this, but that doesn't allow you to do this, and that's going to be extra, and this is going to be extra. Well, you know, here it is. Here's the cloud. It's $30 a month. Just go play.
Yeah.
My feeling is that Adobe thinks this is our chance. This is our time. So let's do everything we can to be innovative and to bring in customers and make customers feel good. They I think they really see this as a pivotal point in their evolution in this market. So I think that's why they're making such good moves and such moves that we enjoy. And
their window of opportunity is pretty limited. I mean, as far as, you know, well, definitely like in the post-production community, you have the, you know, the mass exodus from Final Cut.
Right. So
they have, you know, they want to grab that audience. And then you have like a big shift in web development from Flash-based content or proprietary content to, you know, more open standards. So they're definitely, I think that's kind of the two fronts where their window of opportunity is pretty small, so they have to get it right.
Yeah. And I think to a large degree, they're getting a lot of it right. I mean, I was not an Adobe person, you know, and now I'm just like, I can't say enough good things about them, which is just really weird.
Yeah, to me, it's weird too. Like the really like weird indoctrination that I went through over the past few years, the SF Cutters, the formerly Final Cut Pro user group, we used to meet, once upon a time, we met at the Pixel Core headquarters, and then, of course, it got way too big for that. So they were looking for a venue that was more centrally located and you know, reasonably close to public transit and that sort of thing. So that they had some kind of connection with Adobe. And so we started meeting at Adobe headquarters in San Francisco. And so as a condition of being able to meet there, we had to endure these marketing presentations from, you know, Adobe product managers and such. And at first people were like, oh yeah, sure, whatever. Oh, free pizza. You know? And later it was like, wow, oh, this is really cool. You could open a Final Cut Pro project in Premiere, and then you can have this, you know, dynamic link with After Effects, and you don't have to go through this whole shuffle thing. And wow, this is kind of neat. And, you know, after hearing that repeatedly, it's like, then there was the whole thing with Final Cut Pro X10, whatever you want to refer to it as.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. You know, if those Apple folks keep at this Final Cut thing, eventually they might have a robust editor.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the seeds are there. I think it's a really powerful system, and I think they do a lot of stuff right, but it's the details, man. You know, you gotta sweat those details. And if things like volatility, selection volatility, if that is a thing, then that's a problem.
Yeah, you know,
it becomes unusable.
And to be quite honest, I mean, people who do editing for a living or as a large part of their day-to-day, they didn't want the whole paradigm to be reinvented. I mean, even if it results maybe in better efficiencies down the road, they don't want everything to be completely thrown out and start from scratch. They'd rather to deal with the paradigm that they're used to. And I don't think Final Cut Pro X is that.
Right. Yeah, and especially not have it happen overnight.
Yeah. You know, have a bit of a transition.
Let us down, you know, gently.
Yeah, you know, say, hey, we've got this cool new magnetic timeline thing. It doesn't actually use tracks or anything. But if you press this button, you can go into legacy mode and bam, there are all your stuff. There's all your stuff. You know, that would have solved a problem.
I think the best transitions like that, there's always some sort of, you know, legacy mode, or you can switch to the keyboard shortcuts or layout that you're used to. So if you have, you know, you're dealing with legacy projects, you can deal with it in that mode instead of like, oh, here, all of a sudden, we're going to throw you into this, you know, alien world.
Right. And maybe for a smaller project or a side project that you've got, maybe you'll sniff out the new features and then eventually you'll become used to the new features and you'll switch over. There's going to be a period of time of kind of jankiness where you're using the new software, but you're using it in the old way. But that's okay, you know, because you can still get your stuff done. But to completely cut yourself off from the past, that's a non-starter.
Right. They did all of their user base a disservice by releasing the product when they did with, I mean, really major gaping, you know, usability. Functionality that was just not there. And, you know, and it was a lot of stuff has been added back in the ensuing time since the initial release. But the damage has been done, you know, sadly. I'm sure there's really great features in Final Cut that are worth looking at and are worth, you know, using, but unfortunately I think they've lost their professional audience. The whole thing of not being able to open your legacy
projects.
Yeah. See, that's kind of a deal breaker there. Hate to say it, but
and that's the first thing that comes up and you go, well, no, that can't be right, you know, I'm sure that it opens old projects, and then you're like, it doesn't.
I mean, that was my reaction, you know, and I think that was the reaction that everyone had when they first looked at it at the SF Cutters. Well, it was
Super Meat,
the Final Cut Pro user, Super Meat. Yeah. Everyone was oohing and aahing and saying, wow, that is really, really cool. That's really fresh. Thinking that this is a natural evolution,
right,
natural progression, and assuming the stuff that would be natural to a new version of the same product, which is, oh, of course it will open up the prior version stuff and it'll convert it, and maybe not able to move back to it, yeah, you know, but at least open it up.
And I've heard reports of houses and broadcast houses and various places who had invested heavily in Final Cut for their entire workflow, being told, you know, well, we talked to our salesperson and they assured us that everything would be fine, you know, because we're heavily invested in all of this sand and we've got Final Cut Server, and they said everything's going to, and then suddenly the bottom just drops out one day.
Oh, yeah, because they UOL'd a bunch of stuff too. The Soundtrack Pro, you know, is a great example of that. That's gone. Yeah. Final Cut Server, you know, I know that we were looking at that right before the announcement. We were looking at that for the office, and it was like, oh, yeah, the sales, the local sales guy's like, oh, yeah, sorry, they discontinued it. And it's like, oh, well.
But right up until that point, you absolutely could have bought it and no one would have said a word.
Oh, no. They I'm sure, you know, it was actually probably a good thing we were investigating when we did, because, boy, that would have been went over really well. Oh, gee, this great big expenditure for something that's been completely EOL'd.
And,
yeah.
Your SOL. And I know of places, I know of places that dug in, because when you go Final Cut Server, you really have to dig in, because you have to do a lot of the setup and development of the templating and on your own.
The admin is the admin for that was not trivial. I mean, it was the setup and admin was like, okay, yeah, you're gonna need some resources for that. I mean, so
yeah, it was not how we should say Apple user friendly.
No, I mean my first day with it was, I'm gonna need another pot of coffee. I don't consider myself dummy.
No. And it wanted so much too. It wasn't like you could just buy Final Cut Server and pop it on a mini with maybe some with maybe some discs, you know.
Right.
It encouraged the use of Xsan. It encouraged
the use
of... Yeah,
it was supposed to be, you know, integrated with all that. And like I said, some of these places, a certain music channel that I know of invested in heavily, you know. And so what do they do when they turn around and all this stuff is obsolete? I mean, Final Cut Server is not that old.
No. I mean, not at all. And it's, what's interesting is, what else is out there to take its place? I mean, did anyone else see that coming?
Nope.
Is there anything?
The only thing that you'd have is Avid. something like Avid, where they've always had it and it's just Avid stuff, versus more of a robust media management Final Cut Server tried to be.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's what you'd have to do then, is just, you know, move over to there.
Well, actually, that's one of the things that we're kind of struggling with. All the developers, they all use Git. You know, they'll use GitHub to do all their source control and all that. And that's lovely for text files. But we shove around giant PSDs and giant video files, and there's no real good way to deal with that.
There's a thing that exists, and I won't tell you the names for fear that you might actually try to invest in it, and then you will come back and kill me.
Oh dear.
And then there's a good thing that none of us can have, that Pixar created, but
proprietary.
The thing that I really do enjoy about this show is that, and it kind of ties back into some earlier things, talking about the earlier days of podcasting and deciding how shows should be, what they should be. And we kind of follow that TV model. Everything should be either be a 30-minute news show or an hour variety or something like that. I like the fact that this show is more of, I'm going to show my age, but, you know, like a Merv Griffin or a Johnny Carr. It's just, you know, this is a talking show, and this all we do is we sit down like we're on a couch and talk about stuff, which I really enjoy that. And I'm glad that podcasting has grown to the point where a show like this can exist and actually have listeners.
And that was one of the reasons that I got into it in the first place. A lot of John Foster's shows were patterned in a similar way, which is he just had some mates of his on and they talk about cool stuff. It wasn't necessarily a panel show per se. It was just conversational. It was very much early Johnny Carson. It seemed to be a very relaxed atmosphere where people would just come on and talk about stuff that they were passionate about or interested in. And it was a dialogue. And that was a wonderful thing to witness.
Yeah, absolutely. My involvement was later on with No Tech. But just being involved with those shows and hearing a lot of the, the MacBreak tech, it was such a great format. It's just, you know, it lends itself to being more relaxed, and you're really talking about something you're thrilled about, you're excited about, and that you're with people who share that same passion.
How do we get the band back together?
I'm working on it.
How do we get Ben? How do we get Kenji? How do we get Foster back on the mic?
I've got my best people on it.
Let me tell you.
I will say that it's closer now than it was last week. So
you are a superhero.
Totally.
I am applying not so subtle pressure.
Kristen Possible.
All right, folks, you heard it.
I'm hoping to keep those goats safe. The ones you were going to
the ones that I'm going to sacrifice, because I will sacrifice all of them.
Yeah, he pretty much worked up to all the goats.
Yes, all of the goats. They have weird eyes.
Okay.
Yeah, so oddly enough, I ran into not only Kanan, but Kanji. Both of them were at the SF Cutters last week, so that was very interesting to all be, like, in person in the same room.
Most of the band back together.
Close, and we talked about the rest, so.
Kanan and I have talked about that as a concept as well, and he's like, yeah, we need to make that happen. So I'm trying to, like, flank on all sides. And eventually I think it can happen. Even if it's for one show.
You just throw all these things at the wall. You have lots of different operatives, you know, with lots of different plans of action, and one thing has got to stick. So
exactly.
Right. And suddenly Foster ends up walking into a room and, what are all these mics for?
It's really simple. We just have to put the mics in the bar.
Hey, I am willing to go to a bar if we can have our own bar. I'll just stay there all the time. I'm willing to put that effort in.
I'm down.
You're gonna take
I'm
one
down.
For the team.
I'll take totally. One for the team. I will even test the beer.
Yeah.
Happy to do that.
The 21st Amendment has that upstairs area.
They do, yeah.
I can imagine that you could probably record there with very little fuss.
They've done recordings there, but I'm gonna say maybe with mixed results.
Yeah.
But you know, yeah. Depending on when you were there, like, it could work.
If it were mid-afternoon, I wouldn't do it on a Friday evening.
No. I would not do it, like, during a party at Macworld either.
Kristen Martin, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been fantastic to have you.
Well, likewise, and thank you both so much for asking me to be on the show, and I'm glad we were finally able to get together at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been a mad scheduling thing. Like, I was out, and then I was on holiday, and this and that, and the other thing. It was all sorts of crazy. And, so thank you also for bearing with.
And being our podcast shrink.
Oh, yes. You know, I do what I can. I really do.
and you do it well, so rock the hell on. So where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter, very, very infrequent Twitter, but I could be persuaded to up the frequency. Kristen C. Martin, KristinC. Martin. And then you can find me toiling away in a large corporation.
in unnamed corporation.
On my brand new video rig, which we didn't talk about. We'll save that for next time.
That's true. And we should definitely have you back on, because this was a hell of a lot of fun.
I know, I immensely, immensely enjoyed it.
And Maggie, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at TANKGRRL and at about.me/MaggieMcPhee. And where can we find you, sir?
You can find me on Twitter as well at Octothorpe, OctoThorpe, where I am both quantity and quality. That was another episode of Ruining It for Everyone with your hosts Maggie McPhee and Christopher Harrington. Music provided by Kevin MacLeod. You can find us at ruiningitforeveryone.tv or search for Ruining It for Everyone on iTunes. Be sure to subscribe and rate the show, as it really helps us out.
I'm setting up your grilled cheese tour now.
I love you. I love you.
I'm sorry, I'm imagining Kristen standing in the middle of San Francisco with one of those sandwich boards for the grilled cheese tour.
Oh, I was actually thinking with, like, a really big hat and one of those flags and, like, a giant throng of people just following her.
A double-decker bus with cheese on it.
Right.